Hey, how's it going?
Good, yeah. I've got a corker of a question for you. How do you think humanity will be wiped out? Or will it? Do you think it'll be, I don't know, global warming, nuclear war, pandemic, microbes of some sort? I know we won't get to see the death of our star, but will we get to see the death of our species? Or do you think we'll evolve into a completely new species? Brains in robot crabs. That's my particular favorite. So if we've been around for 100,000 years as us, recognizably us, if we got some bloke from 100,000 years ago, shaved him, put him in a suit, we could make him a computer programmer. So let's say we should have another 100,000 years. Will we make it or will something happen? That's a long time.
If we do make it 100,000 years, I do not think we will be very recognizable to ourselves. I mean, we will play around with our biology to the point where we will resemble ourselves far less than we resemble someone from 100,000 years ago.
Do you mean sort of genetic engineering or, you know, the fact that we're dabbling with bionics?
I'm sure both, but I think at some point genetic engineering will work so reliably and just be so important from a longevity and health and mitigating suffering point of view that I think we'll do it. And then people will get crazy and creative with it too, one must imagine.
Yes.
I mean, like, it's the equivalent of people who get tattoos all over their bodies, right? Like, there'll be those people who are using CRISPR to essentially turn themselves into adjacent species. I don't know how you stop that in the end once it becomes truly democratized and safe and cheap. And I do think that if we don't kill ourselves some other way, I'm sure we'll arrive in some kind of science fiction space like that. You know, just because it's, you know, it's now, if you just look at what's happened with the sequencing of the human genome, you're talking about something that cost $3 billion about 20 years ago. And now it's down to, I believe it's under $300 now. I mean, it's somewhere around $300. So a factor of 10 million reduction in price.
But obviously, you know, politics comes into this, morality. You can't, just because you can do something, it doesn't mean you do it. And I think that in general, that sort of thing is to fight cancer or diseases or, you know, and so in a way, our evolution, that speeded up evolution, is keeping us the same. You know, all our efforts so far has been keeping us alive longer, not changing our genetics or our capabilities or, you know, things like that. And in fact, some would say our evolution has been slower in the last 100,000 years.
Yeah.
Because things aren't being selected on the way they were by keeping everyone alive that wouldn't have happened if we were, you know, cave dwellers. So I think we have to look at time frame, don't we? Because if you look at 1 million years, well, then all bets are off. There's going to be a nuclear war. There's going to be an asteroid. There's going to be a pandemic that, you know, nothing counts. Time allows everything to happen. So let's look at 1,000 years then. You know, 1,000 years ago, we were living in castles and hunting with bows and arrows. Well, I was. Some people didn't have a castle. Some people just had a hut.
Your people were, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Like 100 years ago, my people would have been stable hands. They would not have had the castle. 100 years ago, I'd have been hung for stealing. Because I'd have had to, it's only a lamb, sir. Yeah. Hang him. So, no, but you know, that 1,000 years, I mean, that's an incredible difference, isn't it?
I mean, 1,000 years now is so long, given, I mean, it's unimaginably long. You know, it used to be that you could drop someone down within any 1,000-year window in human history and not much was different, right? I mean,
yes.
And then even when you get into recorded history, things were impressively different, but not really on the scale of a century. So you could drop someone down into what is really the difference between the 12th and the 13th century in terms of technology and
no,
culture.
You're right.
It's not all that much. But
I mean, a big thing was you know, five 5 to 10,000 years ago, wasn't it? You know, civilizations, writing, communications, passing things on, and then inventions.
But even within that, you could live a whole life and not see much change up until fairly recently. I mean, really the last 200 or 300 years, but the last 20 years, I mean, this is a point that many people in Silicon Valley have made, that there's an acceleration of technological change, which hasn't shown, I mean, it does depend sort of how you assess it, but it, by most assessments, it's not diminishing. And if you just extrapolate out into the future, I mean, 1,000 years is unimaginably distant in terms of the pace of change. So it's not a matter of us evolving necessarily anymore. It's just it's what we do with the technology that empowers us to change ourselves genetically. I mean, this will be, you know, artificial selection by virtue of the direct engineering of embryos. And I think there's no question we will do it, because at a certain point it will seem completely irresponsible not to do it. You know, you're consigning people to misery and early death once you have the ability to stop that misery and early death. And so it'll be analogous to, as a parent, putting a seatbelt on your child in the car, or declining to do that. Before the invention of seatbelts, there was no choice to make, and you weren't a bad parent for not using one. But once seatbelts had been invented and it was obvious what the implications were, then you are clearly a bad parent not to put one on your child and, you know, not use a car seat and all that. And the same thing's going to happen with genetic meddling very directly with both embryos and ultimately the germline, you know. And
but there will be counter arguments and fears, you know, because the freedoms, religion, conspiracy theories. I mean, the good thing about science is it works, and so they can't argue. No, look, it works, but they can still say, well, it doesn't mean you have to do it. There's religious groups that refuse life saving medicine for prayer. Okay, and you know, terrible things happen, obviously. But that doesn't stop them. So do you think that when we came out of the dark ages and science took over and it worked and the world accepted it, do you think that will keep going? Or will there be a new surge? Will there be, you know, a new morality? Will there be, because I've sort of seen a move back to some sort of myths and legends. I've actually, only because I'm on Twitter, and hopefully that isn't the, you know, it doesn't get into policy. But there is a rise of people saying, even the vaccine saying that, you know, this is bad in the long run. This is bad. This is bad for your immune system. You know, you'll die of something else. And those things catch hold, and they have to be investigated. Even to the extent that the vaccine that I took, there was about the same number of blood clots, right, from these things as normal. And it still frightened people. And whole countries closed it down because they're worried about the backlash. They are worried about people saying, if this kills us, you're in real trouble. So you've got to fight that as well. You've got to fight. Some people don't trust science. Some people think that science is a liberal conspiracy.
Yeah. Well, I'm really concerned in the short term about this problem, the problem of misinformation, disinformation, conspiracy theories, and just the general confounding of our efforts to agree about anything, right? I mean, just the attempt to have a fact-based discussion about almost anything at this point is really just fraught with political hyper-partisanship, and it's amazingly difficult to just get to ground truth and to acknowledge that you've gotten there on the simplest things. That really does worry me, because...
Well, it's putting the mob. It's really letting the mob sort of sleep easy. I've had it with even sensible people with animal testing, that the science shows that 93% of tests that work in animals then fail and or are dangerous in humans. It literally doesn't work. It keeps going because of propaganda and, you know, kickbacks. The people that breed the dogs get £2,000 a dog. University get kickbacks to do research because the pharma companies, what, et cetera, et cetera. And they've proved that computer modeling already works better than animal testing. But you talk to the average person, they go, yeah, but it might cure cancer. Even though they say, no, it never will, it never has. Everything that has actually been tested that happens to work there was already working. It doesn't work because of animal testing. It might happen to also work then, but you can't get it across because that's such a strong, evocative thing to say that, you know, it might take a billion rabbits to be tortured to death, but your granddad might get over his disease. Now that's compelling. That, you know, that frightens everyone. Even though if you said to them, if you went to their door and said, okay, we might be able to cure your granddad, but you've just got to kick your dog to death. Can we do that? They go, well, no. I go, well, no, we might find something.
But can I put it on my Instagram? Yeah, well, that's, yeah, that'll solve it.
It's like,
it's incentives. It's all about incentives.
It's you know what? It's people thinking they've got the answer and they're happy with it. They don't want to confront themselves again.
But take this one case. So this is much more in your wheelhouse than it is mine, the animal testing bit. So I have an assumption working in the background here that this is a very gray area where, so yeah, the incentives you described are probably distorting many people's thinking here, and that what is probably true, and again, I haven't looked into this, is that animal testing was at a certain point, and for a very long time, the only game in town, right? I mean, it was really the only way to test. I mean, you had a choice between testing in animals and testing in people, and the preference to test in animals, and the simpler the better is an obvious ethical preference. But then at a certain point, it becomes possible to do this in computers. And then that takes hold, and it has taken hold imperfectly, and we could probably shift much more to computers than we have figured out how to do, or that we've been incentivized to do, you know, hence your argument. But that this is a kind of a gray area zone on many.
It's a gray area morally, but not scientifically, because the evidence is there, and there's lots of whistleblowers now that say, in all the years we've been giving cancer to mice, all we found out is how to cure cancer in mice, because it just doesn't transfer. It doesn't transfer to humans.
But I'm sure some does. I mean, some does and some doesn't, and hence the confusion, right? It's like there are probably some diseases for which, and again, I've never done this kind of research. I've never worked on animals, and I explicitly avoided that doing my neuroscience PhD. I just decided that wasn't something I could do ethically. But I'm sure there are some diseases for which results in mice, or even results in flies, translate very directly to application in humans.
But they'd be so general that, you know, you might as well do them on blobs of protein, I assume. I mean, there are some tests that probably told. I mean, I remember in biology, it was about acquired characteristics don't get passed on, and this guy removed the tails of mice, bred them, and the baby mice had tails. So that was an early revelation in the scientific
early
world.
Early breakthrough, yeah.
Yeah, right. So, okay, I'll give them that one. you found that out in mice. But
But to your larger point, for me to truly, on this point, right, to kind of get down to ground truth, I mean, there are sort of surrogates I could use for doing this because, you know, there are people who are very close to this kind of work who I could just ask. And they would have a very strong opinion. And,
well, listen, I agree with you, but there's a sliding scale as well. I totally agree that it's the difference between, you know, giving a chimp with a headache and aspirin and injecting rabbits with poison to see if lipstick will hurt someone. We know there's a huge sliding scale, and I get that.
But this just, I'm not actually adjudicating this point. I'm speaking to your larger point that it requires so much work to figure out anything at this point, right? It's just, and it's, this is kind of a paradox because information has never been more accessible. But in the context of the internet, you can keep any constellation of conspiracies and dogmas alive forever, apparently. You can enter into an echo chamber and not realize that you've done it, whether it's with vaccines or, you know, animal testing or UFOs or anything. It goes on forever. And if you can get stuck thinking you've confirmed all of your biases and intuitions and never get out, because you can always, here's just a a dirty little secret of scientific authority at this point, which has long been known to anyone in science. I mean, you can essentially find a PhD in the appropriate discipline to say anything, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what was happening when the tobacco companies were denying that cigarettes were harmful.
Of course.
You know, you can find PhDs who will, for this, you know, decade after decade, tell you there's no evidence that smoking causes cancer or that it's addictive. And because you can find that for everything, it's a confirmation bias machine if you want to use it that way.
Of course. And that's true of everything. I mean, that is true of everything. It's, you know, even if you've got the facts and the hard evidence and it works every time, people still say, well, people ask me, well, even things based on induction. I did a part of my course was induction, and which basically says, okay, if you throw a brick at a window and it smashes, you go, oh, let's try that again. Does it again. Mm. If every time in the past you've thrown a brick at a window and it smashed the window, you can logically assume that if you do that again, the brick will probably break the window.
Right.
But some people say, I don't know, I've never thrown a brick at a window. And they're right to say that. They can deny gravity if they want. They can deny it. They can say, well, it's not gravity, is it? It's God concentrating on keeping us on the earth. And you go, okay, there's no, you know, you haven't got the evidence in your pocket. You can't show them that gravity works.
Yeah. Well, but the problem with induction, I mean, the famous problem with induction is that it never rules out the exceptions, right?
So, exactly.
I mean, even on this point, I mean, just to flip it around, perhaps you saw the footage of Elon Musk testing the windows of his new Cybertruck. You know, by induction, they'd been apparently throwing steel balls at these windows all day, and they hadn't broken. And then he got in front of his launch audience, and they threw a steel ball at the window, and it shattered.
Yeah. Well, that happened to Tower Bridge. The Tower Bridge is in London. It's never failed except once when it was opened in front of the Queen. So yeah, you know, things, you know. Also, the other problem is that people don't really, and I, you know, it is hard. People don't really understand probability and statistics.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that when you show them the vastness of time and evolution, they can't think of it in those, everything's too perfect. And, you know, I've seen people do, they say, well, it's like throwing 1,000 coins on the floor and they all land in perfect order, right? Okay. And I'll go, yeah, but any order.
Is perfect order.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You just, you know, and I mean, that's the big thing with evolution, isn't it, with people, that they think it has a will. They can't get over how the giraffe knew that it needed to grow that long neck. You know, it is what it is. That's how it fell. The giraffe is how the coins fell, and it worked. That's all you can say with evolution. And time has a massive effect on everything, which is why, you know, everything will happen. And in terms of where our species is going, what's your biggest fear? That you're, forget how we're evolved, forget how we're cure all illness, forget how we'll be slightly different, and, you know, there'll either be nothing that can kill us or everything that can kill us, right? So, but what do you think will be the biggest threat to humanity first?
Well, I think it does go to this issue of what we might call our failures of conversation, you know, our failures to converge on facts and values and to therefore align our various incentives into a common project of shoring up our civilization against all of these possible threats, right? So the fact that we could barely agree, I mean, literally, barely agree. In fact, we never quite agreed that we had a serious pandemic on our hands with COVID. I mean, COVID was a dress rehearsal for something far more dire. And we, you know, we've caught up a little bit in our vaccination campaign at this point, but still, we really did fail to deal with this challenge.
Yeah,
directly, and we still have great masses of, I mean, certainly my society, but I mean, I think basically throughout the West, and who knows what's going on in the developing world, where people are treating the whole thing like still a conspiracy theory and an effort for governments to infringe on the rights of people by calling these lockdowns that are totally spurious and demanding that they get vaccines because Bill Gates has designed a chip that can implant in the body, and it's QAnon. It's complete
madness.
Yeah,
well, you know what? I wouldn't even mind it so much if they really meant it. Just like I don't mind that people really believe that a god made the earth in 7 days. I don't mind it, right? What I don't believe is most of them. I don't believe most of them do believe it. They spread those things because they want to go to the pub. So they go, how can I get the pubs to open? I can, you know, I can cause hassle and I want my own way.
There is that, but some certainly do mean it because they're willing to put their lives on the line in many circumstances where it's, you know, as a test of your belief, it's rather persuasive.
Again, though, I'm still angry at a government who says, you know, listen, the economy is more important, old people will die, than a mob of people are going, this is against our rights. I'm still angrier at a government who says that than the mob.
But even here, there are gray areas, because if you can translate every dollar lost into a life lost. I mean, this is fungible, you know, provided you're going to spend money in the appropriate ways. I mean, we do put a dollar value on human life every day, and we have set our risk tolerance based on these values very directly. I mean, just the classic example is our laws for motor vehicles, right? I mean, if you reduce the speed limit down to 5 miles an hour, virtually no one would die on the road ever. But and so in the U.S. alone, you'd be saving close to 40,000 lives a year.
Well, yeah.
But no one's going to tolerate driving that slowly for reasons of basic sanity, but especially for economic reasons, right? It's just so inefficient, and just the knock-on effects of having everything slow down that much.
Well, people think too many things are their human right, and they're not. They're just like, it's a privilege, or it's lucky, or you live in the right place, or you've got... I mean, even down to... We've talked about this before, that if everyone who ate meat every day gave up meat for one day a week, it would feed 100 million people. It's simple as that, right? Mm. But they say, well, why should I? It's not my problem, you know? And that's a strong argument, really, isn't it? Why should I? It's my, why should I? They don't mean, why should we? They mean, but why are you picking on me? And we go, we're not picking on you, but wouldn't that be a great policy for the world? And, you know, they do think it's in their rights to eat meat every day. And how can we argue with them? How can we argue with the world that can afford it, that it would be better if they didn't eat meat 7 days a week? Where do you start? You know,
well, part of the problem there is the saliency of the connection between my behavior in the moment and its effect on the world. I mean, for instance, if in every restaurant, you know, when it came time to pay your check, there was a button you could push which would translate directly into feeding a starving child somewhere, right? Like you could push this button or decline to push this button. And, you know, if you pushed it, it would add a dollar to your check. And the causality were absolutely transparent. I mean, no one doubted this. You know, this isn't a fiction. This isn't a scam. This is as direct as flipping on a light switch.
Yeah.
Well, then you would recognize that you have to be a monster not to push that button. And people would push it all day long, but because it's the causality is opaque and there's this diffusion of responsibility, it's like, my one action doesn't matter that much because the hamburger in my hand, it's either going to go into my mouth or go into the trash, right? This thing is already made. It's already here.
Yeah.
The cow is long dead. Then it's very easy to rationalize changing nothing about your life.
Well, of course, again, it's that sliding scale that if you're watching someone drowning, and you don't throw them a lifeline. Yeah. That's something else why didn't you go down the river every day and check it? Well, I was busy, you know, and that's a valid point, you know.
To go back to your question, I do think that this failure to agree about things is blocking us on 100 fronts, right? I mean, we can't figure out how to prioritize our spending, you know, collectively, you know, like we should be spending so much more money and marshaling so much more technological expertise on this issue of pandemic preparedness. I mean, if COVID has taught us anything, it should have taught us that, because back to the point about evolution, you know, leaving aside synthetic biology and bioterrorism, evolution itself is guaranteed to present us with a virus that is orders of magnitude worse than COVID.
Of course,
and
of course.
I mean, we just, the clock is ticking, and we know without any possibility of doubt how bad we are at organizing a collective global response. And I mean, if you just imagine what our experience would have been had this thing been killing 10% or 20% or 50% of people infected with it.
Mm.
I mean, we're looking at the collapse of civilization. And
yeah.
And we are right on the cusp of having the technology that would allow us to respond very, very quickly. And so it's just,
yeah,
it's the political incompetence that is blocking us.
We know it's better to think the worst and prepare for it and then be relieved than the other way around.
Right.
That seems obvious to me. But to a point, of course, if there was no pandemic and people said, stay in, don't do anything for 6 months, then people would be angry. They'd go, well, no, see, there was no risk and we've lost our business. And so it's because we don't know the answer straight away. So people think, what if I waste a year of my life and it's not that bad? You know, where's my compensation? And so I understand in the first few weeks why everyone can get it wrong. There's myths.
Right.
I thought I left the letters on my mat for 2 days before I opened them in case I got COVID from them.
Right, right.
Now I think, well, that wasn't going to happen because we understand how it stays on surfaces now. That you know, we know that open air is a lot. I used to keep like 10 feet away from a jogger because I thought, well, his breath's going to go right in my face. He's breathing really heavily. So I think I was probably overcautious. But then,
listen, I still keep 10 feet away from those joggers.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing is, it depends. But I also think that some people, it comes down to narcissism and being heard. We've talked about it before, that this thing of I was here, people wanting to be hecklers, want to be involved. They want to be part of your causal web. Trolls, they want to feel that they did something. And I think, let's think of flat earthers. Okay, it's a theory. We proved it wrong.
You know, I haven't gone down that rabbit hole, but I actually can't believe that anyone believes that. That's just so, that really is a bridge too far for me.
I think at least half of those people that they pretend it's like cosplay.
Yeah.
They want to be part of a gang. They could have taken up train spotting or bird watching. But you know what? They joined the silly gang online because it annoys scientists. You know,
right.
I reckon half of them do it to annoy Richard Dawkins, you know. And it's just trolling. There's no way they think that the Earth is flat or a disc or, you know. But you tell that to children and you keep it in that coal or that fat or whatever, and you do it enough when they're young enough, they will grow up thinking the Earth is flat. And it's as simple as that.
We may be faced with another problem on this front that will be interesting for people like ourselves to navigate. So the other shoe hasn't quite dropped here, but there was recently an article in the Washington Post. This may have been covered many other places, but I saw it there, that the Office of Naval Intelligence and the Pentagon are scheduled to brief Congress about the wealth of data that the government has on UFOs.
All right.
Right. And stuff leaked or was leaked purposely during this last year and got surprisingly little attention. But the rumors that I've heard, and again, this is still just in the mode of rumors, but perhaps soon to be confirmed, is that our intelligence services and the Pentagon are going to tell Congress that this is real, right? This is a real phenomenon, right? It's not that UFOs have been explained to the satisfaction of the government. On the contrary,
they'd have to change their name. They
have seen that there's technology that really can't be of human origin, right?
That
they don't think this is the Chinese or the North Koreans or some other part of human society producing technology that is strange, and they can't write it off as anomalies of perception. I mean, there's just too much radar data. There's too much satellite imagery at this point. And the stuff they're sitting on that's top secret is much better than anything that's been leaked out, right? So this is, again, this is still something that's just...
I'm cynical. when someone says, this cannot be of human origin. That sounds to me like a 50s movie.
Yeah, no, exactly. You know? And many of the details I've heard also sound very goofy, but this is probably premature to even talk about this. But, you know, I have someone reached out to me and has assured me that, you know, I'm going to be on a Zoom call with, you know, former heads of, you know, the CIA and Office of Naval Research and people, you know, whose bona fides are very easy to track. And they're concerned about the messaging around all of this to the public and dampening down panic and conspiracy theories. But the, you know, what is being promised here is a disclosure that is, frankly, either the most alarming or the most interesting thing in the world, depending on how you take it. But it's not a representation of the facts that will give scientific skeptics any comfort. And that's just, you know, we're faced with the prospect of having to apologize to the people we've been laughing at for the last 50 years who have been alleging that, you know, they've been abducted or that, you know, cattle have been anally probed. Pick your punchline.
Well, let me tell you this. Right. I know for a fact that cattle have been anally probed. Right. But it's nothing to do with aliens. Right. It's like, lads living on farms, right? Yes. They hit a certain age.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to be, you know, abducted by an alien, don't go driving around Kansas
in a pickup truck. Yeah,
no witnesses. Whatever you do.
Yes.
Yeah.
No one's ever been abducted in a Rolls Royce, apparently.
No, exactly. Yeah, or filmed it, and everyone's got a camera now. Everyone's got a camera now, and they saw less and less. When the iPhone came out, we saw less and less alien abduction.
Well, this is a point that Elon Musk made rather brilliantly on Twitter. He circulated, I don't know if he created this meme or not, but he showed a graph that had superimposed the exponential increase in the resolution of photographs over the years, which was, you know, just a hockey stick going up to the right.
Of course.
But the resolution of photographs of UFOs, and it's just a flat line. But that's actually, that's actually not,
well,
did you
of
see
course.
The Tic Tac image? The alien craft that looks like a Tic Tac that was shot from the kind of the dash cam footage of a, I think, a naval fighter pilot. It's pretty interesting. I mean, this came out during COVID, and this is kind of a measure of how crazy our year has been that this didn't get more news. But there's more interesting imagery. But anyway, what's being promised is much more interesting imagery still to be released. And it has been reported thus far in the Washington Post. So it's not merely this private representation I've got, but it's...
It's not like I don't deny the possibility of aliens. And I think there's, when someone says, I get it on Twitter, like, oh, you're an atheist. You don't believe in God. What about aliens? And I go, well, that's very different because I haven't got a God to go, well, gods exist, so that one might. But I have got life on a planet spinning around a sun to prove that's possible. And when you think of the vastness of, you know, space and the time, it would be, I think, more unlikely that something somewhere didn't resemble life.
Yeah, but the idea that it's here, flying around, checking on our cattle and our nuclear subs.
Well, of course. I think that's getting, more and more unlikely. As I've said before, I think that we're going to get to a planet, right? There's going to be these super intelligent slugs, and we're going to say, what's the cure for everything? Like, we don't know. We haven't got hands. We're just fucking slugs, all right? We're super intelligent. We're playing with chess. We can't fucking do anything. We got no fucking fingers. It'd be really disappointing. I've got an IQ of 1,028, but I've got no fucking hands.
Just getting angrier and angrier over the ages, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, I mean, I think we've lived probably through the best 50 years of history so far. I think we've been very lucky. You know, in general, society, everything's getting better. Freedoms, medicine, you know, so.
Do you know the philosopher Nick Bostrom? He's at Oxford.
No.
And a very interesting guy who thinks a lot about existential risk and these kind of big questions of humanity's far future and the ethical, our ethical responsibility not to essentially destroy the future, right? I mean, how can we have ethical obligations toward people who don't yet exist and all of that? It's a very, very interesting. But he has this analogy, which I've always found very arresting and troubling. And this is a different, when you ask, you know, what are the things that concern me that may kind of cancel the future for us? I mean, the first is our just inability to cooperate based on misinformation and tribalism and basic stupidity. But even in the presence of great cooperation, there are other problems. And one problem that Bostrom points to is by this analogy is he talks about the urn of invention. I mean, imagine there's an urn and we can pull balls out of it that have can be one of three different colors. There are white balls, which are ideas or technologies or, you know, inventions of some kind that are wholly beneficial, right? There's just no problem. You learn how to purify water for drinking. That's a great thing, you know, all to the good. And then there are gray balls, and probably most of them are gray, where they're inventions that have dual use. You can use them for good or for ill, and this is perhaps greatest example of this is splitting the atom, right? Obviously, we can build nuclear bombs and thermonuclear bombs and destroy ourselves, or we can learn to power our cities without greenhouse gas implications. But then he imagines that it's quite possible, certainly nothing rules it out, that there are black balls in the urn of invention where the mere discovery of a certain idea or piece of technology is synonymous with the cancellation of our species.
Right.
And the truth is we give very little thought to this possibility. I don't even think we understand how we would be mindful of this in some kind of continuous way and prevent a black ball.
No, because I can't imagine one. No, I know. I can't imagine it or it happening or the discovery that would be imminent. I mean, I think lots of things could do that. I think most things are gray balls. You know, you could take a lump of rock. You can build a wall with it or cave someone's head in with it. So I think most things have, you know, dual purposes of good and evil. But so he's sort of like, it's like a Pandora's box, is it? That if you release this thing, that is the end, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, but it's quite possible that we've already got one of those in hand and the implications are just not fully there yet. I mean, artificial intelligence could be that, right? I mean, it could be that we will build machines that are super intelligent, and there's so many more ways to do that in a way that is fatal than in a way that is aligned with our ongoing survival. And we're in the process of discovering that, say. Or it could be that synthetic biology, our ability to monkey with our genes or the genes of anything else, is just synonymous with some high school student breeding a super virus that we can't deal with in a timely enough way, right? I mean, like that it just could be that it's so dangerous to democratize this technology that we're going to kill ourselves with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, he points out that there's so many, we're relying on accident here and good luck so much of the time, because just imagine if splitting the atom, if it just turned out that it was much easier to do than in fact it was, right? I mean, it's nowhere written that it had to be really hard to do.
Yeah.
And if it was just so, if it was easy enough to do, you get a bunch of sand course. And you stick it in a microwave oven and you've got a nuclear bomb, right? We would have killed ourselves, because there's always going to be, you know, one in a million people.
Of course.
Who's, you know, suicidal and deranged and wants to, you know, take everyone along with him, and you would just see cities just disappear under that condition.
Well, absolutely. If I had the power, if I could make people give people a headache or break their leg by just thinking it, if they annoyed me, there'd be lots of people walking around with broken legs. And definitely,
you are the psychopath
sometimes.
That Rick Warren warned me about.
But yeah, did I tell you that? I think I might have told you this when I was about like 6, 7, 8. I used to play, this honestly sounds like something from Dickens again. I used to play in the coal bunker. Do you know what a coal bunker is?
I'm so privileged. Right? I don't even know what a coal bunker is. In fact, truth is, I haven't seen a piece of coal in, it has to be 40 years.
I know. Honestly. Oh dear. Right. Look, okay. We are so different, Sam. So the coalman would come round once a week, right, on a big truck with full of like coal, and you'd buy like a ton for a couple of quid, and it was a little like a concrete shed in the corner of the garden with a flip top. You'd put the coal in there and you'd use that and your fire, right? And as a child, I think I was a lonely child, I'd sit in the coal bunker, right? And I remember reading about this when I was little, and I remember thinking I used to sort of break the coal up because it would be a lovely surface, right? And I tried to make like, you know what I mean, like right. A kid, you know, tried to make like diamonds and, you know. And I remember thinking, I had the little hammer and I was breaking coal, and I was thinking I had to be really careful so I didn't accidentally split an atom.
Right.
But I still took the chance. I was thinking this. So in that confused sort of 8-year-old's brain, I knew about splitting the atom.
And I also
took my chances.
That piece of England.
I know. That is so typical of a kid, isn't it? Remember, you might split the atom. Yeah, I'll be careful. Right, yeah.
That might be the future. A child with a hammer holding the fate of the species in his hands.
That's great. Like 2001 with the chimp throws up the bone. It's me in a coal bunker.
So now, are there photos of you looking like a chimney sweep child from the 1920s?
No. In that time, there's probably about two photos of me. I've got about 30 of me in the bath today on my phone. Right, finally, the big one. Would you, to survive, would you rather have the head of a baby on your body, on your adult body, Sam Harris's body, head of a baby? They have crammed in your brain, but you've just got that little head of a baby, right? And you talk like Sam Harris. Maybe you dribble a bit. You got no teeth. you love milk, right? But you're Sam Harris, right? Head of a baby. They go, this is Sam Harris. And they go, oh, you've got a head of a baby. You go, yeah, get over it. Yeah, don't bring that up.
Do I have
right?
The beautiful skin of a baby, though? Or is it?
Yeah, you got lovely.
Because I will be admired for my skin.
Chubby cheeks, no teeth. Trying to look cool with shades now and again. But the nose is so little, your sunglasses just keep slipping off, right? Or your head, your actual head as it is now, on the body of a baby, right? And they've made some sort of apparatus where you can get around. Maybe one of the, you know, those things you put babies in, they sort of bounce in the, you know, like they've got four wheels. So you probably get around in one of those, or your wife carries you around.
In a bassinet.
In a papoose. She goes around. So you look like that thing from Total Recall.
Oh.
So she. It's a tough one, isn't it? It is a tough one. What's your answer?
I'm going to go with independence here. I don't like the idea of my wife carrying me around. It's a hard trade, but I'm going to go with the body of a reasonably fit 54-year-old man and a very small head. And I'm just, I'm going all in on this. I will be, truth be told, I will do a lot of my Zoom calls with the camera switched off under those conditions.
There you go. Yeah. Well, well done. I think you're right. I think you cracked it there with independence. Mm. I think I'd have to... Yeah, I think the head of a baby wins, doesn't it? Well, I think we've got to the bottom of everything.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Cheers.